Today we have two speakers. Please allow me to introduce them first. The first speaker is Hugh Miller, is a principal at Taylor Fry. For the past 10 years, he has been applying actuarial techniques to social sector problems, spanning welfare, employment, housing, disability, and health. He has a strong interest in analytical techniques and has a PhD in high-dimensional statistics. Hugh is a data analytics editor for the Actuaries Digital Magazine, and was also 2021 Actuary of the Year. The second speaker is Tom Mulder. Tom is a director in Taylor Fry's Advanced Analytics team. He specializes in data analytics, predictive modeling, and optimizing, and evaluating interventions. He works across a range of applications, including insurance pricing, injury schemes, marketing, and customer measurement and government programs. So today, our two speakers will give us a topic on price optimization, which I believe is a very important topic at the current environment, and they will delve into the optimal illusion of this technique. So now, please join me in welcoming, firstly, the first speaker, Hugh, to the stage.
Thanks so much, Faye, and thanks, everybody, for coming along for what I realise is sort of a fairly niche technical paper on the third day of a conference after the gala dinner. The topic today is around optimal illusion. So we're talking about price optimization, and the motivation of this is really not to sort of ask some of the questions that often get asked around sort of fairness, but to sort of ask what are the practical and technical things that can go wrong or that you have to worry about when you think about that topic of price optimization. Few introduction questions there. So what is price optimization? In its general form, it's sort of any sort of change to prices that you're applying to achieve a business objective. We're going to sort of reductively convert that to mean maximising profit subject to a constraint, and that constraint is usually sort of a certain amount of premium volume or a certain amount of something else. So the business objective is often trying to sort of boost profit a little bit by shuffling prices around is one way to think about it. Price optimization is obviously a bigger deal in insurance. It's a big deal in lots of sectors, but I think particularly personal lines insurance has that unique characteristic that it's individualised pricing, and so the ability to shuffle around prices at quite a fine grain level is pretty unique. You don't see it all the time, and so it sort of seems to be a big topic there. We don't often talk about it for technical people. It's a bit of a shame because it is sort of a mildly technical, interesting question to play around with, but I think there are a couple of reasons. One is that there's a lot of commercial IP and sort of strong competitive instincts that mean you don't want to share what companies are doing for optimization. And today we're just talking about simulated data, so we're not getting into sort of actual applied and how companies are using it today. And then the other sort of factor is that it's a little bit ethically grey. So people are a little bit uncomfortable with the fairness implications of price optimization. Tom and I probably have relatively strong views, but that's not really what we're going to be talking about today. You might be wondering what happens in other jurisdictions. In the USA, a lot of states have effectively banned price optimization, sort of judging them to be unfairly discriminative. And in the UK, interestingly, the FCA did quite a big review in 2020, and they banned one type of optimization, which is price walking, so having different prices for new and renewal customers where their risk characteristics are otherwise the same. But they actually said, apart from that, price optimization was probably okay, and it has been sort of allowed to continue, and part of their rationale was that it possibly increased consumer choice. So part of the point of price optimization is that prices do actually go down for some customers as well as others, and so there's sort of a bit of ambiguity as what the overall welfare implications are there. So in terms of what we're going to talk about today, the agenda follows our paper. We're going to skim through the results. It's not a super long paper, but it's more technically involved than we can cover in full today. So if you are interested, check out the detail there. I'll describe our simulated data setup briefly, and then the meat of the section is that section two, where we sort of look at some of the specific issues that crop up, in our opinion, when you're trying to apply these technical optimizations, and then we'll wrap up. So to start off, let's talk about the simulated data setup. So we've got a relatively simple world that we've constructed. We've got a simple relationship between our starting price and profit margin, so just sort of a clean 15% profit margin we're applying. We're assuming a fixed point in time optimization, so sort of everyone's renewing at the same time, you're changing all the prices at once. We're focusing on renewals only at the moment. Most of our results translate okay into sort of new business, but it's not a focus of the paper. So probably a couple of comments in there. Single line of business for now, and a fairly smooth convex demand shape. So all of these simplifications obviously make the things we wanted to do in the paper easier, which is why we've made them. None of them are insurmountable, so if you wanted to extend our results and see if they still hold up, I think they would, and you can apply that to sort of all those things. In terms of a technical setup, I'm not going to run through all this because formulas are death in presentations, but I will sort of point out those first three bullet points there. So we've got just a starting 15% profit margin on our 100,000 customers in our sort of simulated data set. We're applying caps and cups, which is saying we're not going to change anyone's price more than 20%. And we're going to have overall a lowish level of elasticity. And what I mean by that is that if you apply a uniform price increase to the whole portfolio, you end up with more profit, but obviously slightly less demand. And we think that's sort of a plausible way to start. The other comment on the bottom left of that slide is just the optimizer itself. Part of the reason for doing this paper was an excuse for playing with optimizers to see how quick we could make it. I think we've got a little one running, obviously sort of in that slightly simpler environment that's about, somewhere between 10x and 100x faster than most commercial solutions. So that's fun. But these things are relatively fast these days. And I think our optimizer's sort of measured in a couple of seconds for 100,000 people, which doesn't sound too bad. So having besmirched formulas on the previous slide, I do want to talk through one. So this is, if you sort of get the intuition of this formula, hopefully you'll get a little bit of intuition of what's happening under the hood. So this is our formula for profit. It's not a hard one. So profit equals expected profit for a person I is the profit if they renew, and the profit if they renew is just the price minus the risk cost. We assume sort of expenses and everything else is sort of wrapped up in that risk cost R. And the price there you can see is a starting premium and a price change. So the small p is the price change we're applying from whatever that starting premium is. And then the second term is the renewal probability. So that has to be a number between 0 and 1. So one natural way to enforce that is via a link function. So we've used a logit link function as you would in logistic regression. So it's sort of a logistic regression form of a renewal probability there. So GX is the inverse logit function that enforces that constraint between 0 and 1 probability. ZI there is just all the non-elasticity demand terms that might be floating around. So people are different ages or other characteristics might renew at different rates. And then the last bit there is EI times PI. So the EI is the elasticity parameter that we built into the model, so people will have different levels of price sensitivity. And the PI is that percentage price change. So that's one way of sort of operationalizing elasticity. It's not the classical economics definition of elasticity, which is the percentage change in demand divided by percentage change in price. And the reason for that is that sort of that doesn't actually translate well into a probability with a 0-1 constraint. So we've set it up in that way. I think that's a fairly natural way to do it, although the use of the link function and how the elasticity parameter interacts with that is actually quite important, as we'll see. Cool. Once we've got that set up, we can start doing some optimization. And so for people who've sort of worked in the area, a curve like the one on the right probably looks familiar. Typically what you do is you say, let's set a constraint. And our constraint that we've used for most of our results is the amount of risk premium volume that we're taking on. So it's sort of sums of the R's. So in our sort of base case, you can see the top line of the table. The risk premium volume is the second last column there, 67-point thinking before you do any price change, and that makes about $12 million profit. And then to generate the black curve, you actually vary your target amount of risk premium and see how the profit changes just by applying a uniform price increase and decrease. So if we increase everyone the prices 5%, what does that do to risk premium? What does that do to profit and generate the black curve? So the second line of the table is if we target a risk premium of exactly $68 million, we generate a profit of 11.96. And then we apply our optimization and say, well, if we move all our prices in an optimal way, subject to the constraints that we've imposed, and target a risk premium of $68 million, what profit can we generate? And for this simulated data set, our starting point is that 14.25 in the last row of the table, so we get sort of a 19% boost in profits, or about 3% of the risk premium volume. So that's just sort of how we've set up our simulated data set. So if you disagree with it, let me know, but it's all fake. To give you a bit more of an intuition on what's going on, here's a few charts from that basic $68 million optimization. So chart number one is the price change distribution. You can see the spike at the right-hand side for all the policies that get the maximum possible 20% increase. Relatively fewer get the 20% decrease. The decreases in this situation are a lot more evenly spread. And that seems to be sort of, again, one function of how the link works. And so you actually get punished for big decreases more than you do on the positive increase side. The second chart there is just a scatter plot of initial retention rate. So we have an average retention probability of 80%, but people vary based on that ZI term and what price change has been applied to them. And interestingly, you can see quite a strong correlation there. So people with that higher probability to renew actually are more likely to get a price increase. And that's something very important that we'll come back to. Number three there is the price change via the elasticity parameter. That one's fairly intuitive. If you've got a lower elasticity and that corresponds to being on the right of the charts, you're more likely to get a price increase. And then the fourth chart there is a price change by base premium. And again, maybe intuitive, there's not a lot of correlation there. So because we're focusing on profit margin and risk premium, there's no real sort of distinction between high premiums and low premiums in terms of preference of the optimizer, which I think seems correct intuitively, unless there are strong correlations between that base risk and elasticity. And so we toyed around with some of those correlations when we were playing. All right. So I'm going to talk through the first few issues to consider, then hand over to Tom. The first one there is around the choice of constraints in optimization. So we've used that risk premium as sort of our main constraint. So what's the maximum profit subject to $68 million of risk premium? However, there are other choices. So one possible choice you could make is say, well, let's condition on number of customers. And so I want to keep this many customers and maximise profit. And it turns out you get quite perverse skews, or at least I think of them as perverse, because what then happens in that situation, and you can see it on the chart on the right, if you look at starting base premium and see which customers get increases and decreases, very heavily skewed towards increases for the high premiums. So you want to sort of do that to maximise the profit on them. And then you're sort of buying a lot of customer volume by sort of discounting your cheap policies. And so that creates quite an unusual skew on your sort of portfolio. And so it's trying to make that point that your choice of constraint is actually very important and will actually affect how your portfolio looks over time. So you might be sort of actually throwing away quite a lot of profitable but high risk cost customers if you do something like that. The next thing I wanted to talk about was drivers of optimized price changes. So I promise no more formulas after this one. Tom might have a couple. One of the key drivers of the optimization is the derivative between profit and risk premium, which is what you would expect. So sort of for every unit of risk I'm buying, how much profit am I gaining or giving up? And you can derive that explicitly once you've got a formula like we did on the previous slide. And interestingly, at the denominator of the right-hand term there, you've got the elasticity parameter, which is what you'd expect, that does affect sort of whether you want to increase or decrease a particular policy. But you've also got a demand term D, so that's that probability of renewal, and that effectively is modifying the elasticity parameter E, and that is a direct function of that using the link function on top of the elasticity parameterization. So when you've got a setup like that, you've actually got this weird interaction, or not weird, an interaction between demand and elasticity. And not only that, the amount of variation in both of those characteristics will strongly affect how your optimizer behaves. So what the heat map is trying to show is different levels of variability in retention probability on the going across the columns, and different variability of the elasticity parameter in your portfolio going down the rows. So in the top right situation, if everyone's got a very similar elasticity, so not much variation, but retention probabilities are quite different, so some people are 60%, some people are 90%, then the optimizer is effectively optimizing primarily on retention probability and not on elasticity, which is quite interesting. And what it's effectively doing is saying, well, if I increase the prices on the 90% renewals, I'm not going to lose that many of them because they're already sort of in that high part of the logic curve. However, if I increase the probability, if I decrease the price for the 60% probabilities of renewal, I'll probably buy a fairly chunky increase in retention for that. So that's sort of what's going on. And on the flip side, if elasticity variability is high and retention variability is low, then the optimizer is focusing on those changes in the elasticity, and that drives the result. And it does mean that statistical setup is hugely important and potentially problematic, as we'll see. The next thing I wanted to chat through briefly before I hand over is overconfidence in elasticity estimates. So this builds on some earlier work by Simonovich and Pedersen in 2019. And they showed in an even more simplified setup that you have problems when you don't know what the elasticity parameter is in crude terms. And so we've tested that in our simulated setup. We've defined an accuracy parameter T, which is the correlation between what we think is the elasticity parameter that we use for the optimization and the true elasticity parameter. And you can vary that choice of T. And so the charts on the right there just show what happens when you've got an accuracy T score of 0.1. Obviously, you're basically just guessing elasticity for people and hoping it goes okay. And then on the right-hand side, you've got a strong correlation where you've got a pretty good fix on what that elasticity is. And so the question is, how does your optimizer perform in those situations? Which is important because often we don't see elasticity well, and it's quite hard to estimate. So when you do that, the left-hand chart is that sort of optimization curve that we had before, and we've added a new curve, which is the red line. So when we set T equal 0.5, we do actually see a significant deterioration in our optimization performance. How big is that deterioration? Well, it turns out that it's more than 50%. And that's actually a new result. It's slightly different to the Simonovich result, where sort of that deterioration would be exactly 50%. And in this particular setup where we've done that, that red curve corresponds to where that arrow is pointing on the right-hand chart, which is saying that you get 40% of your optimization gains, and the rest is sort of illusionary. So you think you're going to get it, but as it turns out, that sort of doesn't materialize. Interestingly, the cost is more on the volume side than the profit side. So your profit still looks okay, but you've actually lost a lot more customers than you expected, is how that tends to work out. And when you vary the values of T, we actually get a remarkably straight line, and that's consistent with the theory that we've seen before, but the slope of that straight line doesn't necessarily end you at zero. So if you are genuinely guessing elasticity, which is the left-hand side of that second chart, you actually end up below no price, like uniform price changes. So the elasticity is actually costing you money and costing you customers compared to doing nothing, which is interesting and a new result. The subtlety here is that the slope of the red line is quite sensitive to setup. And in particular, it's quite sensitive to that thing we talked about before, which was the relative variability of the retention probabilities and the relative variability of the elasticity parameter. So if we double the elasticity variability and we halve the variability in retention, you get a much steeper red line. And so when you're guessing elasticity, you actually are doing significant harm to your portfolio. So your optimization gains are sort of, in absolute values, the same, but completely negative, which is interesting. And on the flip side, if your elasticity variability is quite tight and your retention variability is quite large, you're effectively optimizing on retention, as we saw before. But what you see is that you actually get away with it. So even if you're just guessing elasticity, you're still making a little bit more profit per volume than you would have otherwise, because it turns out that sort of guessing elasticity is not costing you too much. The message there is uncertainty is actually hugely important, and if the true elasticity variation is low, it still might be possible to just optimise on retention and get away with it. If true elasticity variation is high, you could actually be significantly harming your portfolio. Tom.
Make sure I can work this first. There we go. Okay, so I'll just run through three more considerations around optimization before handing back to Hugh to wrap up. We'll start by looking at model misspecification. And this one's quite similar to what Hugh's just been talking about. So Hugh was talking about misestimating the elasticity parameter. This is sort of a similar angle, but it's thinking about misestimating that relationship between demand changes and price changes. So when we go and build a model, say a logistic regression, we're sort of implicitly making a lot of assumptions. One of them is that link function that Hugh's spoken about, and the other is how we express the price change term in that demand model. So when we've built our base setup here, we're assuming that demand, at least on the linear predictor scale, varies with a percentage change in price. But that could easily not be true in practice. You can think of a lot of things. Perhaps there are discontinuities in your demand function. Perhaps demand varies with dollar rather than percentage changes in price, and all sorts of other things that can mean that structure is not quite right. And it turns out that structural assumption actually has quite a big impact on both the price changes that you get out of your optimization at the end, but also the performance of your optimization, particularly where it's misspecified. So what we've done here is in our simulated setup, so again, reasonably simplified, we've tried to explore a few different impacts of different scenarios where we've intentionally misspecified the structure of that demand function. So we've got three here, which are up on the slide now. Without going too far into the formula, and just quickly running through the alternatives. So in the first one, we introduce an additional correlation between elasticity and customers' base demand. So we're effectively saying that customers with higher base demand have a little bit higher elasticity than we capture in our model. So it's something like a missing interaction. The second alternative is a little bit more of a subtle one. So it's just changing the link function that we use for converting the sort of predictions on the linear predictor scale to probabilities. And we're adopting a probit link instead of a logistic link. They're very similar functions. So just as a reminder, a probit is just like a logistic function, sort of maps values to the range between 0 and 1. But it just does it in a slightly different way. So probabilities sort of ramp up towards 1 a little bit faster than the logistic function. And the third here, it's a little bit more extreme. So it's the scenario where we're pretending that demand changes based on dollar changes in premium rather than percentage ones. So effectively what we're saying is that a $10 premium change for a $100 policy has the same impact on demand as a $10 premium change for a $1,000 policy. So fairly extreme, but in practice you might lie somewhere in between dollar and percentage based changes. There we are. So this next slide looks at the impact of these different scenarios on the prices that you get out of optimization. So what we've done is for each of those alternatives, we've simulated data using that alternative as the true relationship between price and demand. And then we've gone and built a model with our misspecified setup. So that's the one that Hugh described at the start with a logit link function and a percentage price change term. We then run each of those things through the optimization process and see where we end up in terms of price changes. So the way to read these charts is each blue point here is a single policy. The horizontal axis shows the price change that you get if you perfectly specified your demand function, and the vertical axis shows the price change that you get if you'd instead modelled that relationship using your misspecified model. And the takeaway at the highest level is that there's enormous variation in the types of price changes that you get out of optimization just by changing the assumed relationship between price and demand and your link functions. The second observation at the highest level is that if you misspecify it, you get quite a different distribution of price changes than would be optimal under any given setup. So if you imagine that that the misspecification was having no impact, you'd get a sort of diagonal line up these plots, and anything off the diagonal says that you're getting sort of differences in outcome because of your misspecification. I won't dwell on the first alternative in the interest of time, but I'll just start looking at the probit result. You can see there's quite a nice pattern in there. You've got these flat regions, both at the bottom and the top, and it turns out that what's happening there is just changing the link function to a probit. Effectively, it would like price changes that are slightly less extreme than you get under a logistic link. And the reason for that is just that probit function ramps up a little bit more quickly than the logistic function. So if you misspecify your model, use a logistic link instead, you're effectively sending far more policies to the extremes of price changes than you'd otherwise want to. The third alternative here is that per dollar scenario. So it's a lot more extreme. You see there's a huge difference in the prices that come out of optimization. And the reason for that is that under this setup, there's suddenly a real incentive to put through price drops for very large policies and offset them with price increases for very small ones. So you get a substantially different outcome. So the main takeaway here is that these structural assumptions have a really big impact on optimization, but realistically, you often don't know in advance what the right structure is, and you end up effectively making a guess or using some sort of practical assumption. The next slide here gets into the results if you optimize with these misspecified functions. So these are the same sorts of efficient frontiers that Hugh had on the screen before. But we've now got two lines on each. So we've got a blue line, which in some cases is a little bit obscured, but that's the outcome that you get if you optimized with perfect knowledge of your demand function. And then we've got this red line, which sits a little bit closer to the uniform price change scenario, and that's what you get if you optimize using your misspecified function. Actually, interestingly, in the first two scenarios, you'll see that there's not that much change from having misspecified the model. And the reason for that is that the sort of the order of the price changes that you get out is actually relatively similar. Those two scenarios aren't major misspecifications. The third one, though, you'll see is drastically different. So that's that dollar price change again. So you see two impacts. Firstly, the effect, the sort of shape of that efficient frontier is wildly different because you've got quite different price changes. But the other impact is that the impact of misspecifying your model is much higher. You suddenly lose a lot just by having selected the wrong structure. And as I said, that's quite an extreme scenario, but it's quite likely that in reality you'd be sitting somewhere between that and a percentage price change. It's very hard to tell what the truth would look like. Excellent. All right, so moving on to the next section, we'll just quickly have a look at the impact of optimization on the customer base over time. And again, we do this in quite a simplified setup. So the approach that we take is to just optimize for a single year, and then we'll set those prices and continue to apply them for the remaining 5 years. We also ignore new business. So in practice, people are doing things like sort of targeted multi-year optimization that's varying all prices simultaneously. So this is a simplified setup. But what it lets us do is we can come in at the end of the 5-year optimization period and look at how the portfolio has been impacted by optimization. And that's what we've got on screen right now. So these two histograms show the distribution of both base retention and customer elasticity at the end of a 5-year period. The blue bars on the histogram show the distribution under an optimized pricing scheme, and the gray bars under just a simple uniform pricing scheme. And the key thing to take away from this is that those blue histograms are both sort of shifted to the left. And what that means is that optimization gives us a portfolio after 5 years that's got a lower average retention, so we're sort of skewing ourselves towards higher churn customers, as well as a higher average elasticity. So again, we're left with a more elastic customer base. And that's to be expected. You know, optimization pushes price increases onto your low elasticity and high retention customers, and so you lose a few more of them. But what it does mean is that you're left with, in some sense, a more challenging portfolio after 5 years for having optimised. So that's just a cost of optimisation to keep in mind. So this slide here, it's looking at that same setup, but we're just stretching and having a look at how those results change over time. So same simplified multi-year optimization setting. We do introduce a couple more scenarios, though. So what the plots here show, on the left, we show how retention varies from an optimized pricing strategy versus just a uniform price change. And the scale here is in relative terms, so you can interpret 100% as the same as uniform pricing. And the right shows the same thing, but now we're looking at profit. And so what you can see, just starting on the profit diagram on the right, is that you get that benefit that Hugh was talking about in the first year, so you've got a 19% uplift in profit from optimization in this blue line, but that decays over time, and a part of that decay is due to that sort of move towards a more challenging portfolio with sort of more elastic and lower retention customers over time. So a lot of your benefit of optimization is actually being realized early on, and later on you're getting closer and closer to a uniform price change strategy. The other lines on that graph start adding a little bit of noise into your elasticity model, which in some cases is probably more realistic. And you can see that you get two effects. So the first is that your optimization gains are lower, which is in line with what Hugh was talking about when you start adding noise to your elasticity estimates. But the second is that decay rate increases as well. So you're also sort of losing your benefit more quickly over time. The red line we won't focus on too much, but it's effectively an extra scenario where we allow the noise to vary year on year, and we see that your decay increases even more. Great. And finally, we'll have a talk about the challenges of modelling elasticity. So the main thing we want to focus on here is that modelling elasticity, it's fundamentally different to a risk model in the sense that elasticity is a causal modelling problem. We don't observe elasticity directly. We instead observe whether customers convert or not and have to infer what elasticity is based on the differences in conversion rates between customers with different types of price changes. And that's very different to a standard supervised learning setup. In fact, for optimization, more than just estimating the average elasticity, what we really care about is differences in elasticity between different customer cohorts. And so in the literature, they talk about that as a heterogeneous treatment effect modeling problem. And that's substantially harder, again, than just estimating average treatment effects. And so with a causal modeling problem, you get a whole bunch of extra challenges. You'll see in the literature, you know, there are all sorts of conditions that you need to satisfy for causal modeling, but perhaps the biggest one that comes up is concerns around confounding variables. And that's one that we'll get into a bit here. And a related condition is that if you want to estimate elasticity, so unsurprisingly, you need data that explores different price changes for similar cohorts of customers. That's really important, but it's not necessarily a given. So, you know, if you're running the same pricing strategy for many years, you might not actually have a lot of meaningful price exploration in your historical data. And so it's important to set that up if you want to be able to build effective elasticity models. Just a brief aside on modeling approaches. There are a few machine learning methods, so reasonably recent ones, coming out in the literature that explicitly model these heterogeneous treatment effect problems. The one you'll see around, which is quite cool, is this causal forest technique. But there are a few others as well. But in general, they're reasonably sort of immature and academic at this point. So they're sort of more a research tool, and to our knowledge, aren't deployed in production by Australian insurers for this sort of stuff. So what that means is, in practice, at least in our experience, you tend to see elasticity being estimated in the form of a logistic regression or something similar. And so your elasticity is effectively just a coefficient on a price change term in that model, and then your differences in elasticity between different cohorts is modelled through interactions between those price change terms and customer or policy characteristics in your model. So that's what we'll focus on here. So quickly drill into this historical price flex data. So I've said that one of the things you really need to do this well is historical data that contains random price flexes. So ideally you'd be taking some sort of percentage, some random sample of your customer base and just tweaking their prices a little bit and seeing what happens. In practice, that can be quite hard to do. There are a lot of barriers to that. This is by no means an exhaustive list, but you can think of things like technological barriers. It's certainly not a given that anyone's pricing implementation system will support random price changes. There are plenty of ethical or regulatory concerns around pricing based on a random number. Customer experience concerns come up as well. The fourth one's quite a big one that gets a lot of pushback. So if you're coming in and saying that optimization has an amazing benefit and, you know, it's generating 19% extra profit or whatever it is, to then go and say, well, actually, we need to take a substantial portion of the customer base and not optimize them, starts looking like a big cost. So there's a trade-off to be made in sort of balancing that volume of policies that you're randomizing to be able to build good models versus the volume that's going through this optimization process. And then the final two come up as well. So distribution channels, this might be feasible for, you know, a direct online product where you've got a lot of control over how you price. If you're pricing through aggregators or brokers, it can be a lot harder. So if you say, oh, there are all these barriers to collecting price flex data, well, are there other things we can do? And there are a few tempting alternatives, but really not quite as good. The first one is building elasticity models based on historical price changes. So maybe you've updated your risk models, you get a bit of price movement, you can see how demand's responded. That's okay, but you generally end up with quite a bit less data. And often those price changes will be skewed by customer characteristics. So to use a simple example, you know, maybe the change was to increase prices for older customers. That gives you price exploration in some cohorts, but not all of them. So you don't end up with the full range of data that you need. You also end up with worries about confounding over time. So if you're looking at changes across some historical price change, maybe it's your price change that's caused differences, but also there are other things going on that can be quite hard to control for. The second one that's quite tempting is to say, well, I've actually got all of this data from my optimization that I've run on previous years. I know that I've charged different policies, different prices. Maybe I can use that to train my elasticity models. And this is one of the main points that we want to get out of this section, is that that's quite a risky thing to do. It can work, but it requires really careful control to account for biases in that optimized data when you're training your models. And if you don't get that control quite right, things can go quite wrong. So we've had a look at this in our simulated data setup, this idea of, well, what might happen if you build an elasticity model on historically optimized data. I won't get too far into the sort of method we used in the interest of time. I'll jump forward to results. But effectively, what we've done is simulated data in a world where we had perfect price flexes, as we might like, and we've simulated some more data in a world where we've optimized prices historically, and then we've trained demand elasticity models on those two data sets and seen how they perform in optimization. So this table on the right here is it shows the coefficients that come out of the models that are trained on these two data sets. And I might just focus on that far right column, so that E parameter. What that reflects is the elasticity parameter that we get when we build these models. So we show the true parameters, which we know because we simulated the data, and then our estimates from the models trained on different data sets. So you can see that the price flex data has a estimate of that elasticity parameter of -3, which is bang on what we want it to be, and that's what we expect. So it's accurately recreating the data that we simulated. But when we train the model on optimized data, we suddenly get a much lower estimate of elasticity, so -1.84. And the reason for that is that the historical data is biased. So price increases have been applied to policies with low elasticity and vice versa. And the effect of that is to make it look like elasticity is lower than it actually is. So what happens when we run these things through the optimizer? Well, this is what the table on the right is showing. So we can see your profit under a uniform price change strategy and compare that to the profit that we get under these models that are built on different data sets. And you can see the price flex data model. It's a simple model, so you get a fairly modest optimization gain, but 7% profit, not too bad. And most of that's that sort of optimizing on retention effect that Hugh spoke about. But when we use that model that was built on optimized data, there's actually no benefit at all. And that's due to that elasticity misestimation. And arguably, it's worse because you've got no gain in profit, but you've got a much wider distribution of price changes, which you wouldn't ordinarily want. So the big takeaway from here is just be very careful if you're proposing to build elasticity models on historically optimized data. And really, if at all possible, collecting random price flex data is a huge benefit. And I'll just spend a couple of minutes talking about data volumes, which is another key part of this. So we've just been talking, we say, all right, we want this price flex data. How much do we need and how should we structure it? The sort of unfortunate reality is that you need a lot of it. And the reason for that is that optimization is driven by the ability to estimate interactions between customer features and those elasticity effects. And interactions take a lot of data to estimate. Sort of a few reasons interactions are generally smaller than main effects. But you're also effectively modeling on only a subset of your populations. You've kind of got less data to do it as well. A related point is when you're designing these random price flexes, well, how much should you flex price? I mean, you'd probably prefer to flex just a little bit so it doesn't have such a big impact on customers. But it turns out that smaller flexes mean that you need substantially more data to model effects with the same accuracy. So if you half the size of your price flexes, you need four times as much data to build an equally accurate model. So there's a big trade-off to be made there. So again, we had a look at this in a simulated setting. I won't get into our specific simulation structure, but effectively what we've done is tried to simulate how optimization gains change as you vary both the volume of data that you have for training your elasticity model, but also the size of those price flexes within that training data. And that's what this graph is showing. So the vertical axis here is your optimization gains relative to a perfect model. And then we've got different lines on the chart that show how those gains vary with the sample size on the horizontal axis for different price flexes. And the key takeaway here is that more data is better with a diminishing effect. But the vertical difference between those coloured lines is the effect of changing the size of your price flexes. And you can see that that's an enormous change. So that's something to think quite carefully about when you're designing these random price flexes. The other thing to call out, and this links back to Hugh's comment, is that at the far left of the chart, you're actually getting negative optimization performance. And so that's if you don't have enough data, you can very easily misestimate elasticity and end up going backwards. So it's really important to design your processes to collect this data well if you're going to build models that are going to do well at the optimization step. And I might leave it there, so I've got a little bit of time for questions, and pass back to Hugh.
Thank you. Tom asked me to give the concluding thoughts because he thought I'd do it a bit more eloquently, so I'll prove him wrong. So a few key takeaways. We've covered a lot of territory. If you have the wrong constraint, so if you're doing customer volume rather than risk premiums or something, you might be in trouble. If you don't understand well the interaction between your elasticity and your attention probabilities, you might be in trouble. If you have a lot of error in your estimation of elasticity and the parameter there, you might be in trouble. If you misspecify the model structure for how elasticity relates to demand, you might be in trouble. If you're not tracking what's happening to your customer base over time, and maybe if elasticity is evolving, you might be in trouble. And if you're not dedicating a fair amount of your effort to validating price flexing and testing, you might be in trouble. So that's a pretty negative view on optimization. Obviously, if you get enough of those things right, it can work, can deliver profits. I think the point of our paper, though, is that a lot of things have to go right for it to work well. Thanks.
Thanks very much, Hugh and Tom, for the very insightful talk. So due to the time limit, I will just have two quick questions. The first one is, Hugh and Tom, you mentioned there are lots of things could lead to troubles, right? And then, so given this, one of the questions that was asked is what strategies are effective considering the uncertainties and complexities within this price optimization techniques over multi-year horizons?
Is this working? Oh, good. Tom might have comments as well. Certainly, keeping an eye on multi-year is important. Sometimes you're protected a little bit by sort of trying to track those constraints. But the thing that really struck me on the way through is that just looking at profit's not enough, because when you optimise, you tend to put through, on average, a bit of a price increase. And if you've got a relatively inelastic portfolio, your profit goes up. And so it looks like it's okay, but you're actually leaking volume that you then start attributing to other things. So you do have to, like, get that measurement framework right, I think, both on a one-year and in a multi-year basis. So.
Great. The next question, I really like this one, so I must ask this one. So how do you recommend an insurer explains the renewal price to a customer and regulator if the price is out of a price optimization algorithm? So how can you convey this, explain this to the customers?
Oh, I'm going to give an unsatisfying response and say it's very hard. You can do things like explain what factors have gone into driving the price change, but actually decomposing it at an individual policy level and explaining factor by factor what's driven it is really quite challenging. I mean, in the sense that it's sort of a hard message to be telling people. You know, you don't want to be saying that you're pricing on something other than risk. But also it's just technically a very hard thing to do. These sort of algorithms don't lend themselves well to being explained and sort of decomposed into sort of effects of different variables.
Yeah, I guess the other comment is that optimization is relative. So you're not optimizing someone up because they're inelastic. You're optimizing them because they're less elastic than other customers. And so the answer to a regulator is, this is the risk cost, I can explain that well. And based on these things, I think this customer is more likely to sort of stay with me if I put through an increase than other customers. And so automatically it's a hard problem because it's then relative to your entire customer base.
Yeah, thank you. I think one of the complexity within this is that do you want to look at which customers are being, you know, charged based on this? Are they more vulnerable, or, you know, which social status is that kind of customer? Do you think that's something that the insurers should look at?
Yeah, well, certainly that's veering into fairness, which is not the point of the paper, but it's fine. I've heard the argument that optimization's okay because rich old people are the people that don't bother checking the price, and they're the ones that can afford to pay more. So it's actually a very progressive thing to do for insurance companies. I think there's probably some truth in that. So people who are rich are generally a little bit more inelastic. But there are vulnerable groups who maybe don't have the time or the skills or whatever, the energy, to be doing that price comparison regularly, and so do have the risk of suffering that sort of loyalty tax as well.
Yep, thanks so much. Please join me in thanking Hugh and Tom again for the wonderful talk.